This week, WIPR is airing a five-part documentary series, 68, The Fire Last Time. Some people call it a riot. Others refer to it as a citizen uprising. Both terms describe a period of confusion, anger, and tension that engulfed the city in April 1968 following the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Today, in Part 2, we look at the situation which Baltimore faced following the tragic news from Memphis. WIPR's SUNY Collette continues our series.
On April 3rd, the day before Dr. King's assassination, one of Baltimore's afternoon papers, the News American, began a series of reports examining rising frustrations in America's urban centers and what were then called Negro ghettos. The reports, published in a newspaper that usually ignored issues of race, described what sociologists termed the revolution of rising expectations. According to the paper, this meant, when you get a little bit, you want more. Michael Olesker, a young reporter at the News American at the time, explains the way most white Baltimoreans understood the rising expectations of blacks.
A little bit was, okay, we'll let them use the tennis court at Druid Hill Park. We'll let them use the public swimming pools. But if we do, you know, what more are they going to want?
Indeed, expectations had been rising for several years. Black Baltimoreans saw the incremental changes as not nearly enough.
The Maryland Bar Association took a vote and barely voted in favor of letting black people in the Maryland Bar Association. There were no black assistant state's attorneys in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office.
It was in this atmosphere of rising hopes and angry frustration that a match was struck.
My man's gone now.
Thursday, April 4th, 1968. Senator Bobby Kennedy stepped off a plane in Indianapolis. Kennedy was running for the Democratic presidential nomination that year. The crowd who gathered to hear him speak was mostly African American. Standing before them, Kennedy delivered the tragic news from Memphis.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis.
The news of Dr. King's death spread across the country. In Baltimore, people spoke of a collective, mournful groan.
I remember walking into my dining room and my wife telling me that they had murdered King, and I cried like a baby.
Homer Favor was teaching economics at Morgan State College.
I cried like a baby because I said, when is it going to stop? They're killing the prophets. When is it going to stop?
Rosalind Terrell lived on North Avenue and was a young mother with a 10-month-old son.
It was a feeling of hopelessness. You know how you feel when you've had your last chance. Your last chance has been taken away from you.
I remember that there was an Afro-American woman standing on the steps, and we knew each other a little bit.
Jim Constantinidis was a student walking through the campus of Loyola College.
She looked at me. She said, "Did you hear what happened?" I said, "No." She told me, told me what had happened, and her tears were just in her eyes, and she said, "Do you know what this means? Do you know how bad this is going to be? There's going to be hell to pay for this."
I was in the pool room where I spent most of my life.
Little Melvin Williams was one of Baltimore's premier hustlers.
Someone came into the pool room and shouted out, "Man, he just killed Dr. Martin Luther King." And all of a sudden, there appeared to be more people in the street than ever before, as I can recall.
You could feel tension.
Lenny Moore had just retired as a running back with the Baltimore Colts.
It was a question of what was going to happen. When was it going to happen?
He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay. He spread this message all across the land.
By Friday evening, riots had begun in dozens of American cities. In Baltimore, emotions were running high. but there was no explosion on the streets.
We were 24 hours behind other cities.
Reporter Michael Olesker ran to his newsroom.
And it was like nothing was going on anywhere in the world. There was just the usual crew of rewrite people and the usual callers phoning in with whatever news tips or whatever problems they were having with their taxes, the usual gentle lunacy. And I heard a voice saying, "Typical Baltimore Negroes." And I turned around and I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "They're rioting all over the country. Why can't they do it here?" And his point was, they had every right to.
Mayor urges calm. City joins in mourning. Reads the headline on the front page of the News American that Friday. It stated that Mayor Tommy D'Alessandro gave city employees the day off to mourn, and there would be a full statement at 4 p.m. by City Solicitor George Russell, himself a Negro, according to the paper. Marvin Mandel, then Maryland Speaker of the House, sums up the feeling among officials at the time.
I don't think it was anticipated that it would happen in Baltimore because there was not that strong feeling. The relations in Baltimore were a lot better.
Michael Olesker said Baltimore City's politicians thought they had reasons to believe they'd made at least some progress.
Tommy said, I think we've established good relations here. His father had put up the first public housing that by this point had become black. The Flag House projects, for example, right across from Little Italy. And Tommy had he had appointed the first black city solicitor, George Russell. He made Marion Bascom head of the fire board. And he also had a relationship with Martin Luther King. I mean, they had met. They had dined together and got along pretty well.
Tommy D'Alessandro ordered the city's flags flown at half-staff to honor King and reported on the situation to Governor Spiro Agnew.
Even at that time, early Saturday morning, things were relatively calm. All the reports coming back were relatively good, but I did mention to the governor that it looks too good.
By Saturday, the national death toll from the riots had hit 19. The headlines in the News American that morning captured the tense situation. Agnew gets emergency powers. Maryland Guard maintains state of readiness. In Baltimore, the National Guard, armed with bayonets and guns, had been ordered by Governor Spiro Agnew to stay close. Agnew also requested federal troops be on call to move into the city if necessary. Mayor D'Alessandro made sure the police and fire departments were ready.
We went through the checkpoints of, were we in good shape police-wise, were we in good shape firefighter-wise, were all the communications ready in case of any trouble.
D'Alessandro also began calling on black leaders for their help. Criminal defense attorney Billy Murphy, then in his last year of law school, was living in Cherry Hill in South Baltimore at the time. His father, William Murphy Sr., was a prominent member of the community.
Immediately, every black person of significance and many of insignificance were recruited to keep the eruption down.
Murphy says there was some ambivalence at first.
There was some resentment in the more militant parts of the community about being asked to calm black people down so that they wouldn't express their rage. But after the thought process matured over a day or two, it became clear that it was in the interest of the black community to do this, even though it was being initiated primarily by whites.
Tommy D'Alessandro.
My hope at that time was that if we could have made it to Sunday morning, when the Ministerial Alliance and the black churches would be open for services, if we could make it to Sunday morning, then we would have made it.
I don't think Sunday morning could have saved anything.
The Reverend Marion Bascom was one of the black leaders recruited by the mayor. He was part of the self-styled Goon Squad, a group of ministers and prominent activists who were part of the local civil rights movement.
But what they didn't understand was that Sunday belongs to a few worshipers, that there are far more people out in the streets on Sunday mornings than in church.
Bascom said it would take a lot more to alleviate the racial tensions building on the Baltimore streets.
Baltimore was a replica of what happened all over the country. New Orleans, Miami, Birmingham, Washington, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, you name the city. It was a spontaneous outpouring of frustration and pain. So it was not something that could be localized as a Baltimore thing. It was bigger than Baltimore.
Well, I always had the sense that everyone who was in a position to do something or who was trying to do something, they were working in conflict with one another almost.
Joanne Robinson was studying history as a graduate student at Johns Hopkins and active in the civil rights movement.
The mayor clearly, with his day of mourning and so on, wanted to keep the emphasis on Dr. King's death and on honoring him and trying to quiet it down. They gave passes out to some of the black leaders to stay out on the streets and talk. But then the troops come in and they don't recognize the passes and they end up arresting men who were supposed to be out there and had been asked to be out there to help and throwing them in jail. And, you know, there was just desire to try to calm things down and to try to express grief, but on the other hand, with Agnew and the military mentality coming in, that just undermined everything that people who were trying to do something positive were doing.
By Saturday afternoon, April 7th, Baltimore's racial divide was widening. Tommy D'Alessandro was beginning to see signs of trouble brewing.
They showed me a pamphlet that was being distributed by some in the Gay Street area, that they better close down their stores to commemorate the death of Martin Luther King, but sort of in a threatening fashion.
My father had the business, Lewis Furniture Company, on 700 block North Gay Street.
Ted Gammerman helped his father manage the store located in the heart of one of the city's main shopping districts.
People would come in and say, you better clear out because they're going to start having riots down in the 500 block, and that they'll be working their way up here. You better close up and go home. And that's what we did around 4:35 o'clock.
Sometime around 5, a brick was thrown through the window of one of the stores on Gay Street.
By the time we got home, they were already rioting. On North Avenue, they were rioting. They were rioting. They started on Gay Street, and the whole city was starting to have problems. And then someone called us and told us that the building was burning down, that they had set the building on fire. They threw a Molotov cocktail into the window.
The Lewis Furniture Store burned to the ground. Eventually, the family reopened in another location with donated stock.
We grew up down there. I was raised down there. I went to school down there. I didn't think they should have went about burning down people who worked there and lived there all their life and had to start all over again. I thought it was, but I can understand their frustrations too. They were frustrated, and once somebody starts doing it, the other ones follow suit.
It seemed a day that just being white was the wrong complexion.
Melvin Williams spent a lot of time back in 1968 on Pennsylvania Avenue on the city's west side. Most of the black businesses there, he says, were untouched. But the stores belonging to whites were looted and burned. Many of the business owners were Jews who felt betrayed that their longtime customers had turned against them. But Melvin says the fact that they were Jewish was irrelevant to the rioters.
This was because somebody white had just killed the biggest black on the planet. There was no way that with those persons that were rioting were going to be able to decipher that these were Jews and the people that killed this man were not Jews, they were rednecks or whatever they were. They were not going to be able to disseminate the difference of that these were whites, period. These whites own things in this community, we're going to destroy it.
Devon Wilford Saeed was one of the many teenagers who felt they had a right to loot the neighborhood store.
We had a market right down the street from where we lived, right there, Preston and Harford, called Crown's. A lot of people were complaining about the store because they would switch their prices and sometimes they sell us bad meats because we young, we didn't know, you know, and our mother had to send us back to make changes. And the racist remarks sometimes, you know, that we receive when we go into the store, you know, sort of like, we had a fixation on getting these people that owned this store out of our community, you know, because they were mistreating the blacks.
Fire alarms went off all night up and down Gay Street. Two people, one black, one white, burned to death in a blaze at Federal and Chester Streets. The city moved to ban the sales of alcohol, flammables in containers, and firearms. That evening, some 6,000 Maryland National Guard troops, under the command of Major General George Gelston, entered the city.
We were called to home to report right away.
Wilson Thornton Jr. was in the guard. He says his unit met at the Pikesville Armory to gather weapons, ammunition, and tear gas canisters.
We convoyed again straight down Reisterstown Road, down Pennsylvania Avenue, to Pennsylvania Avenue and Biddle Street. When we got to Pennsylvania Avenue and Biddle Street, the firefighters were down there putting out fires. People were looting, I mean, running up and down the street with boxes of Kotex and all that kind of stuff. They were cutting the firemen's hose. When we got down to that corner, the fireman said, "I'm glad to see you guys."
Speaker of the House Marvin Mandel was in the Virgin Islands when he got the news that the city was quickly descending into chaos. He hurriedly flew back to Baltimore.
When I flew in, I want to tell you, the sight of the city burning, it was like a castle being stormed in the old days with all the people trying to break through the walls and get into air. The flames were all over the place. The fire was all over the place.
Mandel rushed to the 5th Street Armory to meet with local officials.
Towards the nighttime, we were able to somewhat get it under control. We had to put a ban in. No one could walk across the streets at night.
The curfew on Saturday night went from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. The restrictions caused hardship for some and bruised feelings for others, like Rosalind Terrell.
In order for me to work, I had to get a pass from work to let them know that I did work in order for me to be able to come in and leave out of my neighborhood. Although I knew that it was a security issue, but to me it was really a humiliating kind of thing to have to show a pass to come in and out of my own neighborhood.
Joanne Robinson recalls the scene from her apartment in Charles Village.
We were at 2649 Maryland Avenue, and right up the street on 26th Street, the National Guard set up an encampment. So you didn't have to go out on the street. You could just look out the front window and realize that you were living under martial law.
Devon Wilfred Saeed remembers the curfew this way.
When they had the National Guard to come out, you know, to try to keep the order because people were just going chaotic. They was, like, looting the stores. They were beating white people up. White people that they would just see walking down the street, or if they were in their cars, they throw rocks at them.
The city's jails were filling up with looters and with thousands of people simply caught up for violating the curfew. Many said they didn't know about the curfew. Colts football teammates John Mackey and Lenny Moore headed downtown to the Civic Center, which was being used to house curfew violators. Lenny Moore.
The temperature was rising. They were packed in there. And you could see the police kind of like on guard. They would not let anybody go to the restroom. They gave them a cup to relieve themselves in the cup. When we got down there, it was about ready to break loose.
Inside the Civic Center, people were hungry too. Feeling the tempers would escalate into violence, the football stars took matters into their own hands.
Hold off, just be cool, and we're going to get this straightened out. Said so. Boom, we got on the phone.
Moore and Mackey called SK, a local meat processing plant in East Baltimore.
Something to get some food in them, lunch meat, and something where you could make quick sandwiches. And we called the Blue Ribbon folks, and so that the Blue Ribbon folks could get us bread that we needed. We called for mustard, ketchup, and we ended up making sandwiches for all those folks down there.
As for the bathroom situation, Moore and Mackey helped the police work out a system to take the detainees in groups. Meanwhile, was clear that the curfew would not be enough to restore order. Marvin Mandel remembers there was pressure to take stronger measures.
They had the Attorney General of the United States was calling us because we had half of the, I think it was the 82nd Airborne Division, sitting out on the highway. The governor had asked for help from the federal people, and the mayor was beside himself because this was a real tragedy in his city at the time. He just didn't know whether he wanted to have the military come in and take control or not, and we kept getting calls from the Attorney General's office over in Washington that we couldn't let him sit there on the highway.
Mandel recalls that Governor Spiro Agnew was frustrated with the indecision. Eventually, Agnew went back to Annapolis, and Alessandro did order the federal troops into Baltimore. Mandel tells of one scene he saw on the floor of the 5th Regiment Armory as federal troops were preparing to deploy.
There was an Afro-American captain of one of the companies that was going out on the streets to patrol the streets. And on the floor of the armory, he said to his troops, if anybody's walking on the street because there's a curfew, you order them to stop. If they don't stop, you order them again to stop. And if they don't stop the second time, shoot them. Well, the press was standing there, and you could hear the gas was shooting them. And he turned around, looked right at the press, and he said, look, I want to tell you something. You see all those men lined up there? They have survived Vietnam, and I'm not going to get them killed on the streets of Baltimore.
And with those orders, day one of the 1968 Baltimore riots became day two. I'm Sunni Khalid for WYPR.
68, The Fire Last Time, is produced in part by a grant from the Maryland Humanities Council. Join us tomorrow night for part three, as the city's residents, store owners, as well as local and federal troops react to the violence and tensions on Baltimore's streets in the wake of Dr. King's assassination.